First up, we are going to discuss the Defence Forces. Joining me now is the President of PD Forum, Mark Keane. It's good afternoon to you, Mark.
Very good afternoon to you, Keane.
Mark, I was reading this a little earlier on in our newspaper review, and I have to say I really was so surprised by this. If we just compare the 420 prisoners in the island of Ireland would receive €2 more to get those meals each day. Yet the people who are defending this country and obviously doing great humanitarian work across the globe are to be fed for three meals for €4.20.
Yes, unfortunately, the situation is something that's ongoing at present. As you correctly say, there is a difference of at least €2 between what other sectors in the public service would get to feed people and what the Defence Forces attract at the moment.
Now, obviously, Mark, humans are humans at the end of the day. People will argue that people in prison need to be fed, which they obviously do. You know, you can have your own opinions on that, but we can understand that. But are you not just left scratching your head? Or if you're a member of the Defence Forces, doesn't it just, you know, a total, I guess, insult to you that you're not as highly regarded in terms of sustenance as somebody who's in a prison at the moment in this country?
Well, unfortunately, the military and our members have been left behind previously in different things. We often said that we were the Cinderella of the public service, where we were, you know, forgotten about, and we were always given, you know, the least thought. It is hard at present trying to justify €4.20, in a sense, trying to feed people three times a day. Now, in saying that, I'm sure the prison officers or the prison service would tell you that they're struggling on €6.20 to feed people as well. So, you know, if you take the rate for overseas, it's upwards of €10.20, €10.50. We're a long way from that. And what I mean by that is what the United Nations deem that soldiers, airmen, sailors, whatever, deployed on international peacekeeping or peace enforcement missions, that's the allowance they pay you. So in short, they would say, like ourselves, that they're well behind that as well, and they're struggling to keep up with inflation on that figure as well.
Mark, are you able to give listeners an insight as to the type of meals that Defence Force members would be served with this €4.20 a day?
Yeah, most definitely. It'd be the same as your average household, I suppose, or if you were attending, you know, a hotel or a carefree lunch. Not enough, it's breakfast in the morning. Lunch is various choices, from scaly bonnets, pasta dishes, to curries, to fish and chips, homemade pies, lasagnas, things like that. The same again that evening, you would have, we try to do a variety of choices, maybe two, three choices in the evening time, although there is a dessert served with that, and on occasions you might do soup and things like that. But we are really constrained in what we can do, and it is a constant balancing act with the €4.20.
I just keep going over it, and I think about myself, yeah, and I think about other people, you know, pre-pandemic, you know, a lot of the time people would say my age in their 20s would be going out for food, and €4.20 would barely buy you a cup of coffee. So it really does bring home just, I guess, how little it is that one can feed themselves off and how privileged so many of us are. But in terms of that €4.20, it's literally per person per day for those three meals, €4.20 would cover them there. There'd be a lot of people around this country that would currently say, Mark, that they would find it very difficult in terms of inflation and the cost of food to feed members of their family for €4.20, three meals a day.
Yes, naturally enough, inflation has a big part to play in the consumer price index. We've seen the price of foodstuffs, you know, rise sharply in the last number of months, over the last 2 years especially. The difference would be, if there was a difference, is that the Defence Forces would tender for 16 military locations, which would include the Naval Service and the Air Corps. So you wouldn't, sense, be bulk buying, so you would award a tender for your meats, your poultry, your fish, your fresh vegetables, fruit, things like that. So it's the quantity then would come into it that would be based on that, you know, you'd have
right,
the buying
yeah.
power. You know, so that gives you that, I won't
okay.
say much of a leeway, but a certain leeway with the €4.20.
Mark, how do people actually move forward here in terms of, you know, discussing a topic like this with government and actually seeing change?
Well, the first thing is that we need to admit that there is a problem with it currently, that the €4.20 isn't sufficient. It was 2008, when the country was facing into a harsh economic climate, that the allowance was cut from the pricing sum of €5.20 down to €4.20. That has never been revisited, so that's over 14 years ago. Inflation, as I said, has crept upwards. We've seen the Brexit and COVID has put a dramatic cost again on foodstuffs. We need to, first of all, to sit down with the department and the minister and revisit the allowance of 420 and see where we go from there. As I said previously, upwards of €10.50 is what is awarded by the United Nations for our troops currently serving overseas. So if you do the maths, we're €6.30 in the difference there already. So there's a long way to go.
Yeah, exactly. Look, Mark Keane, the president of PD4, thank you for joining me this afternoon and discussing that. And as Mark rightly pointed out, that is what the United Nations maintains. The daily ration for such vital military operation should be €10.50. And the government has stipulated that €6.30 a day be given for rations to those serving with the naval service on the life-saving Mediterranean Sea migrant rescue mission. But in terms of the military chefs, they're given €4.20 per person per day. That's for three meals throughout the day, and it's quite incredible when you read those figures. It is quite incredible that they're able to do that. What do you think about that? Are you surprised by this figure? I'd love to hear from yourselves. Do you feel that you can feed your family €4.20 a day for three meals a day? I think there'd be a lot of people out there struggling to do so. I know, you know, when you think about, you know, the basics like bread and pasta, you can get those a lot cheaper nowadays, you know, due to the, I guess, options in terms of the grocery stores, etc. But it seems as if it would be a real stretch to do so. As Mark did point out, the Defence Forces are buying in bulk, so that will obviously help them in terms of reducing the price. But get in touch with us this afternoon. It's 0833 97 97 97. Joining me now is the solicitor specialising in employment law and dispute resolutions, Richard Grogan and Associates. And it is Richard Grogan and myself. It's good afternoon to you, Richard.
Good afternoon to you. I hope you're keeping well.
I am good. Thank you very much. Now, you have spoke out this morning about employers needing to be given legal permission to ask about staff and employee vaccination status against COVID-19. Obviously, vaccination status has been a huge story in terms of sport over the past few days with Novak Djokovic over in Australia, that, you know, people feel they need to know about the people entering their country in terms of their vaccination status. Then you can understand why employers may need to know about their employees coming back to the workplace and their vaccination status.
Yeah, well, this really is more actually for protecting everybody in the workplace. This is not just an issue for employers. This is an issue for employees who are in the workplace, that they have confidence that somebody coming back in who is a close contact is vaccinated and that the rules have been complied with. This is the problem. We don't actually have rules. We have guidance.
Okay, so, and just reiterate that guidance for us, Richard, so we are up to date with what currently is out there.
Well, what we're told is coming up is that if you're a close contact and you're fully vaccinated and boosted, then you can go to the workplace, provided that you have no symptoms. You have to wear a mask, a medical grade mask, and you have to do antigen testing.
Now
if you're not vaccinated, then you have to stay out for 7 days.
Okay, Richard, if an employer may decide that they want everybody working for them and in the building to be vaccinated against COVID-19, what does that mean for the employees' rights?
They can't do it. It's illegal.
So in terms of needing the legal permission to ask about vaccination status, could potentially an employee lie to the employer and say, yes, I'm vaccinated, to know that the employer wants them to do so? There's no real guidance around that part of it.
Oh, there is. The employer asks you that question. As the current law stands, the employee says, thank you very much, I'm heading off to a solicitor, I'm suing you for breach of GDPR for simply asking me. That's contrary to the Data Protection Commissioner's rulings. This is why, in relation to this issue, people coming back to the workplace who are so close contact, that method have to say, yeah, this is a medical issue. Now, at the present time, if you work for the HSE, they got the derogation. They're allowed to ask the question. But if you're working for an ordinary business, they can't ask the question. And a lot of employees themselves are very concerned if somebody's coming back into the workplace, particularly if they know themselves that they're not vaccinated.
Yeah. And hypothetically, Richard, obviously when it comes to legal stuff like this, you know, it takes years in the making for things to change, or a lot of work and focus on one particular issue, which I'm sure the COVID-19 vaccination status of people will receive. But if it was the case that employers can decide that, you know, Richard Grogan can't come back into this office because he's not vaccinated against COVID-19, potentially, will that be allowed under Irish law? Can you see that happening as a professional yourself?
I don't know. I mean, the difficulty we have at the present time is that we've had this pandemic for 2 years and nobody's done anything about the employment law side of things. You know, they know that the problem are there and everything is, we'll be fine in about 3 months' time, don't worry about it. And that's been going on since the very start. So the difficulty here is that claims are beginning to stack up and there's going to be an awful lot of claims against employers simply for trying to keep staff safe. But the answer is they could be breaking the law. This is the problem. This is a very simple thing for NPHET to deal with. And this is only for somebody who's coming back in, who's a close contact, or they've had COVID, that you turn around and say, look, you know, I need to see the vaccination for allowing you back into the office on this particular date. Otherwise, you have to go for the longer one. And then there would be a choice for employees to say, well, I don't want to answer the question. That's fine. Then we presume you're not vaccinated and you take the longer period out.
Richard, people seeking your help and guidance at the moment and looking for your help professionally, that is, are the vast majority coming, when it comes to employment issues, coming about vaccination status?
A lot of people are coming, a lot of employees are coming to me concerned, who are perfectly healthy and they're concerned about being in a workplace with somebody who has COVID, because we have cases coming in of people being called in when they had COVID and the employer saying, oh, look, this is only guidelines, you can still come into work.
And where do people stand on that? If I was to come to you and say that that's happening in my workplace, what can you do as a professional?
Well, the first thing is we'd get them to put in a complaint to the HSA. No, not the HSE, the HSA.
The Health and Safety Authority, yeah.
Secondly, we would tell them to send an email to their employer, which basically says, I put in a complaint to the Health and Safety Authority. I'm coming into work under protest. But by the way, if I'm a close contact or I have COVID and you've called me in, I'm going to be telling everybody when I come in that I come across, look, by the way, you know, I've got a positive antigen test, but I've been told to come in, go, you want to stand well back from me because I could be contagious. See how long that lasts. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the answer to it. Because if the employer then takes any detrimental or even a threat of a detriment against the employee, there's a claim under the Safety, Health and Welfare at Work Act. Now, you know, and this is crazy stuff, because an employer brings somebody in who's got COVID, you know, no matter what the pressure is, that can have the whole place closed. It might never open up again. I mean, this is, you know, I understand the pressure that businesses are under. Now, by the way, businesses are coming to me and saying, look, we know we have a person here who's a close contact. They're saying they're not a close contact, but they've told other people who they're working with that they're a close contact. But I can't ask them about their status. I can't ask them about this. And we're going, no, you can't. No, you can take the decision to send them home, but because you've made that decision, you have to pay them. So this is a real problem, and it's been going on for a while.
It's so complex, Richard, isn't it? There's just so many different things. And as somebody who obviously is no professional or expert in the legal world, hearing things like that, it makes my head hurt. All the potential things that can happen in regards to this. And
but that's the government needing to get on to a few employment and health and safety solicitors and saying, you know, can we set you up on a Zoom meeting? What are the problems that you're seeing? How do we address these? And how do we minimise the risk for employers and for employees? Mm-hmm. Because this is something that, you know, we're told that there was nearly 20,000 yesterday, but the real figure may be 50 to 60,000 people who got it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get COVID and I don't want to see anybody else get COVID.
No, of course. To be fair, I think most people out there, no matter how they feel about vaccines, etc., they don't want to be sick if they can avoid it. And obviously, having a safe workplace, if they have to be there physically, would be top of their priority list. Listen, Richard, I could speak to you for hours about this. I find it very interesting. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. That's Richard Grogan, solicitor specialising in employment law and dispute resolution. Coming up after the break, we'll be speaking to Alex Cooney of Cyber Safe Kit. Now, if you're listening to us this morning, you will have heard that there is a bill to be regulating social media, online advertising and streaming services in this country, to be signed off by Cabinet today. The Minister for Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media, Catherine Martin, she was bringing the memo to government seeking the publishing of the Online Safety and Media Regulation Bill. Joining me now to discuss this is Alex Cooney of Cyber Safe Kids. Good afternoon to you, Alex. Alex, I believe you should be there now.
There is a press conference on. Actually, I was hoping to go, but it's closed door, so I don't have access to it. But the press conference is starting in a couple of minutes, where the minister will announce the amendments and the revisions made to the bill.
Yes, sorry, I meant you should be there on the line now. We couldn't hear you for the first few moments. No, I understand that, and thank you for keeping us up to date. Just let our listeners know exactly what this bill would be seeking to do, especially when it comes to the social media side of things.
Yeah, so this bill was actually first introduced in 2020, early in 2020, and then in December there were some amendments made. So what we're seeing today is the follow-up to the pre-legislative scrutiny and the Joint Oireachtas Committee report, which was published, I think it was the end of November. So it's the revised legislation coming into force, and it's about regulating harmful online content and putting in place greater accountability in terms of the online service providers.
Now, Alex, you wouldn't have heard this, but earlier this morning I was speaking to a local woman. She's a grandmother. We gave her the pseudonym of Mary, and she was discussing the situation with her granddaughter. In recent days, her granddaughter came forward to her older sibling, showing that she had been receiving awful abuse via social media chat. And Mary came on to, I guess, you know, encourage parents, loved ones, guardians, whoever it may be, to check, you know, younger people's phones and the access they have to and the chats they may be part of, etc., etc. And in that case, it's great to see that a young person has reached out, whether it's to their older sibling, whoever else in their life. But what advice could you give to people listening now who worry for the younger people in their lives and want to encourage them to come forward? Maybe it mightn't be to them, but in general, how do we encourage our younger people to come forward and speak about the abuse they may be facing online? And obviously, when it comes to online, it's 24 hours a day. It's not like, you know, oh, it's just for those 8 hours you're in school, which is obviously 8 hours too long to be receiving abuse. That's not what I'm trying to say. But it's literally 24/7 now.
Yeah, and I'm so sorry to hear about that earlier caller. It is horrific, and unfortunately we hear of these cases all too often, and certainly they're coming up in schools as well. I think the key thing here is conversations. We would really encourage parents and carers to make it normal to talk about what their children are seeing and doing online, to have regular check-ins, to have them on their devices in family spaces. And obviously all of this is easier to do when children are younger. As they get older and they're in their teens and they need a greater degree of privacy, those things become harder. So we would encourage that, you know, healthy online practice from as young as possible, and you know, being really careful about what your children are allowed to sign up to, the games and apps that they're allowed to download, you know, being informed in terms of making the decisions about whether they can and the extent to which they can. So, for example, if you're agreeing to allow your child to be on TikTok, for example, ensuring that you have some good ground rules, that you're aware of that platform and you know, the pluses and minuses of it, and that your ground rules address those, that you're keeping an eye on what they're doing and what they're posting, and so on. So these things are a really good practice. But I do want to emphasize, and this is where the legislation comes in, it shouldn't all be on the shoulders of children and their parents. You know, we do need to put some of the responsibility back onto the platforms. And that's what this legislation should be about today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll go through a little bit more of that in a moment. But I know, Alex Cooney, you're tight for time this afternoon. So thank you so much for joining me, Alex Cooney of Cyber Safe Kids there. So just going over the bill in general, as I was saying, it also puts the responsibility onto, as Alex mentioned, onto social media platforms themselves and things such as streaming services like the Netflix and the Disney Pluses of the world. So it means that this new body will be responsible for overseeing them and the new regulatory framework for online safety. It has the potential to be one of the most powerful regulators in the state, this media commission, as it will oversee all media, including tech companies. So it's overtaking or taking over from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. So it's also going to be regulating both television and radio broadcasts. The general scheme of the bill underwent extensive pre-legislative scrutiny for, as Alex mentioned, most of last year. And the Oireachtas Committee published a report on it in November. You know, they're talking about putting a levy on streaming services such as Amazon Prime and Netflix to fund independent Irish productions, which would be great in terms of, you know, arts in this country. We know the arts sector has been, or industry is one of been one of the worst hit over the past 22 months. So yeah, very interesting there. And of course, thank you very much to Alex for joining me. Now, just breaking news this afternoon, Britain's Prince Andrew will face a civil sex case trial after a judge in the United States dismissed a motion by his legal team to have the lawsuit thrown out. And the motion he had basically was his accuser, who is Virginia Roberts Giuffre. She lives in Australia. She's currently living there with her husband and family. But she is an American herself and has taken the case up in America, obviously, where Jeffrey Epstein, an associate of Prince Andrew, was living. He did die back in 2019. In a New York prison, they believe died by suicide. And we know last month his close aide Ghislaine Maxwell, she was found guilty of helping to facilitate the grooming and abuse of young teenage girls, which is exactly what Virginia Roberts Giuffre is accusing Prince Andrew of, saying that she had sex with Prince Andrew on three occasions, starting when she was 17 years old. So obviously she would have been not underage at the time. She was not an adult. So as I've been saying, he will face a civil sex case trial after a United States judge dismissed the motion. Is that the first member of the British royal family to face a civil trial in another country? I'd be very interested to find out a bit more about that. I will do a bit of searching in the next few minutes when I play the next song. But before I do that, we've got a text in 0833 97 97 97, and this texter would like to stay anonymous. But we were speaking to Richard Grogan about, you know, the stance employers have about bringing people back to work, potentially if someone's a close contact to COVID-19, etc, etc. So this texter says, my 23-year-old daughter was bullied back to work recently by her employer. She was a close contact in late December and subsequently tested positive for COVID-19 in early January. She was contacted nearly daily how she was, asked if she was vaccinated and or boosted. And when she read out her HSE text, which advised her to isolate and reduce her contact, she was told these texts are guidelines only. I was so upset for her. She was so distressed when she was ill. Her employer didn't care how she was or if she was recovering. And I feel like a lot of people are in that same situation. I'm really sorry to hear that, because it's such stress on people's shoulders. They're feeling like, oh, I've got to, you know, hold down this job. And obviously over the past 22 months, when things have just been so up in the air about what's going to happen, they feel even more pressure to keep a hold of your job. So if anybody has any advice out there for this texter, do get in touch with us. 0833 97 97 97. Just reminding you that the OR409 from Halverstown Cross to Carra will be closed until further notice. You would have heard throughout the morning a road sweeping vehicle struck the Liffey Bridge in Carra just before 8 o'clock last night, Tuesday. The driver did escape without injury. Kildare County Council have noted that diversion routes will be in place and will be clearly signposted. And Councillor Rob Power did speak to Owen Beattie a little earlier on Kildare Today, and he was mentioning that two other bridges within the county also had minor incidents, and thankfully nobody was hurt and there was no injuries or anything in a particular, I guess, worry in terms of that. But just since that was such a big story today, I'm mentioning it because my next guest, who is Ciarán Cuff and the Green Party MEP, he's asking the National Transport Authority to consider narrowing lanes and junctions to discourage motorists from speeding. And it's hello to you, Ciarán, and thanks so much for joining me.
Good afternoon.
Ciarán, a lot of people just in this county at the moment, after what we've heard in the past few hours in regards to narrow bridges, it just so happens that one of the bridges I'm mentioning here is quite narrow in the village of Carra in this county. So I guess the interest might peak for some of our listeners, you asking the NTA to consider narrowing lanes and junctions to discourage motorists from speeding. We live in County Kildare, obviously one of the biggest motorways, or the biggest really, aside from the M50, goes through this county every day. We hear of so many issues that happen. So would that make a difference, do you feel, on a place like the M7 when it comes to speeding? Because isn't speeding something that more affects our rural roads rather than, I guess, the main routes?
Well, it's a real mix, and just like a diet or a New Year's resolution, a diet isn't for everybody, and you have to think quite carefully about what roads you might consider a road diet on. And I'm certainly not suggesting that we kind of take a lane off the motorways leading out of Dublin, but I think particularly when you take some of our towns and villages and housing estates just all around Ireland, you often get a T-junction with a wide sweeping corner that cars speed around, and it can be quite difficult to let your children cross a junction like that, or for anybody, myself included. And that's where the thinking nowadays around Europe and around the world is that some of these junctions need to be tightened up a bit to make it easier and safer for both pedestrians and cyclists to get around. And it all depends on the particular junction. You mentioned the problems with a narrow bridge there. Clearly, there's places where it doesn't work, but there's also places where it does.
Right, yeah.
And there's been some good experience around Dublin with some of these initiatives.
Yeah, as you say, it's hard for everybody to, or not everybody, but for every road to follow one rule. We can understand that. And then in regards to our callers, they've been in touch with Dimna this afternoon. Pat in particular on 045 901490 says these junctions are very narrow for HGVs and buses. So if they reduce the width, it will be dangerous. What do you think about that, Ciarán?
Yeah, that's a good point. And actually, going back, I mean, my background, I'm trained as an urban planner and I have a background in transportation. And when a lot of our kind of housing was set out in the kind of 60s, 70s and 80s, the view was that two fire brigades should be able to kind of pass each other almost at full speed. And that led to a lot of roads being very wide and the junctions being really built around the needs of the car and the vehicle rather than around the needs of people. I mean, in a nutshell, in the late 20th century, the car was king. But what we're now actually realising is that the car, in a sense, was a pretender to the throne. It's actually people who should be at the top of the transport pyramid. And we need to design junctions and roadways a lot more about the needs of the pedestrian, and particularly vulnerable pedestrians, the elderly, our children and others. And yes, in some cases, it does mean that a HGV has to slow right down to a crawl at these junctions. But that can only be a good thing. And there's a lot of new guidance on this. There's an Irish publication called The Design Manual for Urban Roads and Streets. And it actually contradicts a lot of the guidance that would have been given, let's say, in the 1970s. So we're really rethinking transport from scratch. And I guess in 30, 40 years ago, we felt we wanted to give the green light to cars and other vehicles everywhere. And now we actually, we talk about placemaking, we talk about improving the public realm, and particularly in smaller villages or in towns, we want to make them much better places to live in, to spend time in, and to get around on foot, particularly when we look at the kind of the climate challenge. We want to make it easier to avoid driving if we can.
Well, obviously, you know, being a member of the Green Party, I know that's something that's of the utmost importance to yourselves and within your party, and I can understand why you feel like that. But I just want to revisit the housing estates in particular, Ciarán, if you don't mind, in terms of the limits. Currently in this country, is there a limit for every single housing estate that they have to have in terms of speed?
No, there isn't. And there is certainly a strong school of thought that we should bring in what's called the Love 30 or the 30 kilometer limit. Would have been 20 miles an hour in the old money. But the idea is that we,
which, Ciarán, I feel is very fast for you know, I know you're not saying that, but even for an estate, you know, you think there's 30k at the moment in Dublin city centre. 30k in a housing estate would just, it just seems way too fast. I know you're not deciding that in general, but you know, for such a built up area like a housing estate and houses so much closer together and potentially children on the road, etc., etc., 30k, it's probably way too much. You'd probably really need to see something like 10 or 5.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you said that, because certainly when I was first proposing 30 kilometre limits 20 years ago, people said that was madness and a car couldn't go at that slow a speed. But now I think it is time to talk about 20 kilometre limits or even 10 in certain areas. And to some people that will sound crazy. But if you go to Germany, you will see that residential areas of 30k, if you're near a school, it's 20. And if you're beside a playground, they essentially say you have to go at 10 kilometres an hour. So I think there is a convincing case for lower speed limits. And a point that often comes up for me, a lot of Dublin still has 50 kilometre limits. Now, some people would say you shouldn't bring down that speed to 30 kilometres, but maybe 40 kilometre limits, which are used widely in cities like Copenhagen Paris.
Yeah.
So I think we need almost a whole new suite of speed limits, ranging from 10 up to 20, 30 and 40, rather than the 50s and the 80s, which is what a lot of county engineers see as the default speed limit.
Okay, well, Ciarán, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. There are a few people who are getting in touch with us. That's Ciarán Cuff, MEP for the Green Party. And somebody has called in 0459014900 saying a lot of housing estates, this is actually a really good point, are just drive-throughs to other roads or estates, especially the newer housing estates. It seems to be that that's the case. And meaning that, you know, people do tend to speed and to drive too quickly. So thank you, caller, for that. And we have a text in on 0833 97 97 97. Marion in Salins, how are you this afternoon, Marion? Nice to hear from you. We have had road markings or road marks highlighting the cyclist lane here in Salins village for years now. Now we have bollards. I drive an average size people carrier and just about fitted in the car lane. Very interesting. My concern is how in God's name can delivery lorries, larger trucks and buses drive through Salins without going into the car lane on the opposite side. The green are a danger to humanity. That's from Marion and Salins. Very interesting there, Marion. But fair enough, that is your feeling on that. Now, I'm going to move on to a very different topic. Joining me is the board director with the National LGBT Federation, Adam Long. How are you, Adam?
Hello, Ciara. Good afternoon to you.
And good afternoon to you. Thank you for joining me. You're discussing today this global study on gay conversion therapy. But just before we get into it, just explain briefly, if you wouldn't mind, Adam, what exactly gay conversion therapy is.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for having me on, Ciara. So basically, so-called gay conversion therapy, it's a widely discredited practice that's aimed at changing or curing somebody's sexual orientation or their gender identity expression. And it's a practice that's been condemned by all the reputable experts in the, you know, in the area of health and science. And it's very damaging. The United Nations, for example, they term it as a form of torture. And that's exactly how it should be viewed. So, yes. It really does need a prohibition.
Mm. It is quite scary when you use the word torture, because I think a lot of people, it reminds them of the incidents that happened with the US in particular when it came to the Iraq war and the torture that was used on Iraqi civilians and soldiers, etc., waterboarding. So when you use the word torture, it really does, you know, astonish you, because that's exactly how a lot of people are viewing this. And the UN have expressed concern at the activities of a global study on the therapy has expressed concern at the activities of two providers of the therapy here in this country.
Yes, and I think the report by the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, I think it's very welcome, because again, it kind of adds to the research and it adds to the knowledge, you know, of just how insidious, I suppose, this practice is, and what there needs to be, you know, clear legal interventions. But I think it's particularly welcome in the context of Ireland, because I think it really dispels the notion, or any notion that may exist, that this practice somehow does not exist in Ireland. As you say, the activities of two groups have been highlighted in the report. And I think it also underlines the need for an island-wide ban, because there's no point having legislation in, you know, in one part of the island in one jurisdiction, and then somebody being able to, you know, cross, you know, go over the border, you know, and practice this so-called therapy. So I think that is indeed very welcome. But I think another aspect of the report as well, well, two aspects, Ciara, which deserve to be highlighted. One, I suppose, is the influence of the US religious right, you know, I suppose kind of the religious extremist element in the United States, which unfortunately has quite a lot of traction there. But we now see that their influence, again, a light is shone.
Now, Adam, when you mentioned that, are you speaking about disinformation that the report has highlighted in particular?
Yes, so a lot of it, you know, would be online advertising, for example. And again, this really excellent report, I suppose it highlights how social media companies need to be much more vigilant and much more proactive in terms of, you know, they do have policies, or they, I suppose, belatedly, some of them have introduced policies against hate, extremism, disinformation. But the report, you know, makes clear that, you know, those who peddle this, as I said, torture, that they're finding ways around it.
And so, I just want to quote the report in terms of that disinformation. It says here, one of the authors of the report says, in quote, the tech companies made a pledge a couple of years ago to de-rank disinformation related to conversion therapy. So that's obviously not happening.
Well, as I said, the report makes clear that, you know, it's not adequate, that the steps that have been taken certainly need to be bolstered, because we know now, in, you know, in this day and age, that so much, I suppose, awareness and advertising and reach is online, and it's, you know, and I think what's particularly, I think, insidious about the activities of those who peddle this practice is that they're reaching, and they're able to reach very vulnerable people. I mean, we know the statistics, for example, LGBT people, because of, I suppose, that legacy of discrimination and ongoing issues. You know, particularly young LGBT people are very vulnerable. So you have these groups, I think, maybe peddling on that vulnerability. And perhaps, Ciara, we could also then maybe talk a little bit about Irish efforts here, you know.
Well, I just wanted to ask you exactly about that, because you mentioned, you know, the US religious, I guess some people may call them cults, some just religion. Where does Ireland weigh up in the whole situation when we do compare ourselves to the US across the water?
So basically, I suppose kind of the first legislative step really towards banning the practice was in 2018, and that was a bill introduced by Senator Fintan Warfield, and at the time it did receive wide support. And as I understand it, or as we understand it now, government is working with that bill, and, you know, and seeking maybe to, I suppose, kind of, you know, make it more make it more appropriate. But I know they are discussing, the government are in discussions with Senator Warfield around that. But more recently, we now actually have, I suppose, a steering group that's been set up, and that's LGBT Ireland and the Rainbow Project in Northern Ireland, because again, it's very important that this is seen in an island-wide context. So a steering group under the leadership of Councillor Alan Edge, he's the campaigns officer. So, and I'm on that steering group as well. So we're basically, I suppose, working, you know, around trying to secure, well, there's two aspects to it, Ciara. First of all, it needs to be a comprehensive ban. So that means that there can be no loopholes or no exemptions, for example, on the grounds of religion. Because a lot of this, unfortunately, does happen under the, I suppose, kind of within the context of religious practice. And again, I would draw your listeners' attention to what the UN Special Rapporteur for Religious Freedom said. He said that everyone has the right to practice religion, but nobody has the right to harm others through religion. So that's what's happening in this context, clearly. And then the second point would be that it has to be, certainly we'd be calling for it to be fully LGBT inclusive. So it needs to cover both sexual orientation and then gender identity expression. And we can look to other jurisdictions, Ciara, you know, for good templates. Canada only this week, actually, their ban went into effect, and that's a really good, solid piece of legislation. So, you know, we can follow others in that respect. Canada is one, and states in Australia, you mentioned the United States, states there have banned the practice. So hopefully now Ireland will be able to join that list, you know, before too long.
Yes, and I advise anybody who wants some more information on that to check out the report itself. And there are a lot of articles online just in regards to it. In this country, there's two places or two providers, I guess, of the therapy on this island. One is in County Down. It's called the Core Issues Trust. It's based in that county. And it's also X Out Loud. That's what's connected to the Core Issues Trust there. So yeah, very interesting stuff. Listen, Adam Long, Board Director of the National LGBT Federation. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. Take care of yourself. And just before I go, I want to let you know that there is a, we're speaking about, you know, keeping safe on the roads, etc. And there is a fog warning for County Kildare and the whole of Leinster and Munster, which will come into effect at 8 o'clock this evening. It's a yellow warning. It'll be in place until midday tomorrow, Thursday, so 12. And Met Éireann is warning fog or freezing fog will develop this evening, becoming dense overnight. So obviously stay aware tomorrow morning and keep those fog lights on, both front and back if you have it. I know not all cars have it front and back, but that is the advice.